Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. We are listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Live. My heart is somewhat saddened, the passing of my next to elder sister, Cornelia Gordon Booker. Cornelia Gordon Booker Powell, my elder sister, returned back to her creator, and she will ever be in my heart. When we say return back to the creator, that is, we are to remember that person for that great work. And my sister was a great, loving the sisters of my mother of a daughter, and my big sister. My regret was I was not able to be with her. She requested that her baby brother, she see him before she shut her eyes. So may God give her eternal rest. We have a great program today for you. We're going to commemorate one of the greatest events in the history of humanity. A people up from slavery. A people up from Reconstruction. A people up from the worst bondage in the history of people. That people strove and worked with all of their might to build a community. And they did it. And then the devil came and set that community on fire. 300 of our people perished. I believe that if we are a people, homosexuals celebrate Stonewall. The Irish celebrate their great battles. The Jewish people celebrate their great battles, and out of those battles, they form the history and their culture. And out of this great massacre, as is, our enemies call it, a riot. It wasn't a riot. It was a massacre. So, dear beloved people, I would like now to bring to the mic. I'm going to bring to the mic one of my, being the duty of a radio host, also of a father. One of my sons has slipped, but he'll be all right. Dear beloved people, I'm going to have with us Brother Imam Arthur Farrakhan, who will go more in detail with the issue of the African-Americans and what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Brother Imam, welcome to the mic.
All right, thank you, Brother Imam. As-salamu alaykum. And we offer our condolences for the loss of your sister. We lost one of our pioneers and had janazah for him on Thursday. We had saw him the previous Friday, and when he came to Jumai, he was extremely happy. And always a happy person, always a big smile, always laughter, but more so looking back. And that was the last time we saw him alive. The following Friday, he was found, his body was found in his house. And it looked like he had expired or passed maybe 2 or 3 days before Jumai Day. And we're just reminded that we never know. You know, when this would be the last time that we see somebody or the last time somebody will see us. So, we've heard that a lot, that we should tell people that we love them, you know, let them smell the roses while they're alive. And this brother's name was Brother Amin Rawlinson, a giant here in Oklahoma. And we were asked to officiate his janazah, and you know, it brought back some very warm memories for myself as well as others. We thank you, Imam Alfred, for giving us an invitation to speak on your show. You have a great show. And we pray Allah that it continues to grow and that more and more people hear about your good work and be about the work of duplicating where we are. Today is an infamous day here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Today, May 31st, and tomorrow, June 1st, is the 93rd anniversary of the 1921 massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I would ask our listeners to help us to correct history by not using the language that the destroyers of our dream named it, referred to it as the 1921 riot. It was not a riot. A riot signifies complicity on both people's part, like our ancestors had a role in all those lives being lost and all those buildings destroyed. It was completely premeditated by envious and jealous Caucasians, along with the involvement of the city government and the police department. So 93 years ago, today and tomorrow, we had a massacre. We had a massacre that still affects us here in Oklahoma, here in Tulsa. And and they use the excuse that it was done because of a black man by the name of Dick Rowland assaulting a white woman by the name of Sarah Page, and that was the excuse used for the massacre. One of the things that Allah has blessed me to do is to put a little history together in a music format to make it more palatable to be heard. And what I would like to do is to play a song that we wrote and recorded, What Really Happened to Tulsa's Black Wall Street. And then at the conclusion, and it's not long, it's 16 minutes, 22 seconds long, at the conclusion, then we'll have some more comments. But this introduction will fill in a lot of the blanks and a lot of the questions that I know your listening audience will have. So let me play this for you, and then we'll come right back on the mic, please.
Please do, yes, sir.
I'm sorry?
So please play it. I'm anxious to hear it.
Okay, thank you.
Ready, ma'am? Ready, ma'am?
Pause it just for a second to ask if that sound is about right. Is the volume about right?
I couldn't hear it. Can you turn, let's see.
I wasn't hearing it. I put it on the speakerphone and put it a little closer to the mic.
Yes, sir, please. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. All right, hold on. May 31st. And June 1st, 2010.
I can hear you now.
Night,
okay.
Worst civil unrest in the history of America, not counting the Civil War. It was called the Tulsa Race Riot, and over 300 people were killed. Much has been written, and many stories have been told about what really happened. We must set the record straight. First thing that you must know if you really care is that it was not a race riot, but a race massacre. Stop calling it a riot like you were there. Innocent people, men, women, and children killed everywhere. It was a setup, a scheme, or a plan to destroy all of Little Africa or Greenwood land. Some say to lock up the destiny of Greenwood in other people's hands, saying to the world that he's not really a man.
You better stomp an ass Jackie Chan if it's all right to destroy someone else's land. It began on May 31st, 1921. What a scandalous front page story that was a lie. It implied that a black man attacked a white girl and had to die. The actual front page story of the Tulsa Tribune newspaper said, nabbed Negro for attacking girl in elevator. Those killing words were never taken back later. That's all that was needed to lock up Dick Rowland in the Tulsa jail. And that one arrest created major hell. He'll tell, he'll tell. That stopped life on Greenwood from going so well. The editor and owner of the Tulsa Tribune newspaper was Richard Lloyd Jones, and he knew the power of the pen. He turned a mob of 25,000 whites against Dick Rowland so that Dick would not have one friend. He even wrote an editorial entitled "To Lynch Negro Tonight." Many, many whites and blacks spoke loudly that that's not right. The name of the young lady who was used to create so much rage was a young white girl by the name of Sarah Page. She told authorities over and over again that Dick Rowland had simply slipped and stepped on her toe. But that was enough for Richard Lloyd Jones to say that Dick Rowland had to go. They came from the east. They came from the west. Determined to give Dick Rowland a long rest. They surrounded the courthouse and demanded that the sheriff let Dick Rowland go. This was just the beginning of the fiery and bloody show. Several men from Greenwood, a little Africa, went to the courthouse and offered Sheriff McCullough their support times too. They knew what the angry mob intended to do. They remembered that an angry white mob lynched a white teenager named Roy Belton in 1920. They knew that Dick Rowland did not stand a chance with the angry mob being so many. Then, bang, 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 someone fired a shot with their finger on the trigger. Then the mob shouted with one voice saying, "Kill all them niggas." All of this rage because Richard Lloyd Jones stole lies about Sarah Page, releasing the inhumane mob from their cage, putting in the hand of a savage a 14 gauge, letting it loose on innocent people with all of that rage. The truth must be told so that this will never happen again. It's time for whites and blacks to be each other's friends. If we trace it back far enough, we will find that we're all kin. But it seemed that we were not kin on that day. The mob was determined that all blacks had to pay. They set fires to everything as they went their way. They were determined to burn and kill no matter what the innocents say. They went into Little Africa, burning and shooting everything that they saw, killing innocent men, women, and children, beating them to the draw, killing the parents of little babies, Maul and Paul. Some of the innocents dodging bullets all the way to Arkansas. 1,256 homes in Little Africa destroyed by fire for no reason. We must tell the truth, and it is not treason. This is the justice season. The newspaper headline saying, "Little Africa on fire. 35 blocks burned to the ground." The mob was determined that no one be left around. Not a grown man nor a baby clown. This is the way that it really went down. a full all-out massacre on Gravertown. The mob went from house to house and business to business, setting fire to everything because Little Africa went up in smoke. This war against Little Africa was no joke. The mob was even able to hide behind a legal cloak. Told the police officers, deputized mob members, and told them to get a gun and get a nigger. More love has been shown to dogs and cats and a horse called Trigger. Survivors hiding under beds of their houses heard mob members say that no nigger should live better than us. Keep killing him, I won't be no fuss. And burn that nice furniture into dust. They even brought in at least 6 biplanes and firebombed Little Africa from the air. They firebombed the new Mount Zion Baptist Church. They did not care. And they stocked the decks so that the race massacre would not be fair. They even pulled guns on the fire department and would not let them put out fires in Little Africa that day. They did everything that they could to make Little Africa go away. Them niggas trying to do for self and spending money with each other. We better stop them now because they ain't our brother. The brave citizens of Little Africa put up with a heroic fight, even though being outnumbered 10-1. They were not going to give up and allow the mob to have their crazy fun. They made their last stand on Standpipe Hill and were doing pretty good to stop some of their blood spill. Then something happened that will make your blood chill. The massacre on Standpipe Hill. The National Guard started shooting 2 machine guns at the heroes, killing many to destroy their will. Kill, kill, kill was the order of the day. And even begging for their lives and praying could not make it go away. The mob was determined to have the last say. Make Little Africa go away. Oh, say, 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 can you see that America is the land of liberty and that all of us have the right to be free? No one deserves to be hung from a tree. Everyone that you have ever hung is me. Hell no, you don't want that history in school books or on TV. The survivors of the massacre were forced at gunpoint to hold up their arms and march to the fairground, convention hall, and McNulty Baseball Park. This was so humiliating, you would think that they would have let them march after it got dark. The physical massacre finally stopped, and the survivors were left free to go home. Nothing left but ashes, bricks, and human bones, even though most of them had to still repair their loans. They even had to fight all of the insurance companies who refused to pay just one claim. The survivors were treated like they had the wrong name. Shame, shame, shame. Black Wall Street burned completely to the ground. And many, many, many of its citizens will never be able to come back around. In the ground, in the ground. The massacre of Black Wall Street continues to this day. It's just being done in a different way. Government is having too much say. Then we hear good news about how green will be restored through a new program called Urban Renewal. Just wait and see. We're done waited and waited. It seems like a big lie to me. Urban removal would be better to describe what really went down. It was government-sanctioned removal of what was left of Gravertown. Where are the 600 black-owned businesses that were up and down Greenwood for a whole mile? Somebody needs to be put on public trial. No one was ever arrested or charged with the race massacre on Greenwood in 21. Now we move up to modern times in the continued quest for justice for those who are blessed to survive. History proves that they never got justice, but continued dying. Like steam from an organized beehive, with only a few of the original survivors still alive. Let the record show the legal efforts of attorneys Johnny Cochran and Charles Ogletree to move justice from stop to go. They took it to federal district and appellate court, hoping to get justice for the survivors' nation. The federal district and appellate court dismissed the suit, stating the statute of limitations. Unheard of! Statute of limitations when it comes to murder? All the world knows that this is a bad deal. And guess what? The Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal. Around the same time, the government changed the zip code of Greenwood and made it part of downtown. I wonder how it would have went down if survivors of the massacre had been around. Yes, new little Africa town. What happens to dreams deferred? Do they die and dry up like raisins in the sun? You didn't kill Greenwood's home run. Dan Pipe Hill must always stand. All of the blood spilled makes it sacred land, sacred land. It should not fly away like Peter Pan. I wish that I could shake every survivor's hand and say, how do you do? We promise that we will not let the world forget what you went through. Hallelujah, hallelujah. I will tell my children too. How could you? I know that we must teach, and real humans we will reach. We promise that we will not cease. I know that there is one more major issue that we must find a way to tell. That's about the settlements that are creating so much internal hell. Settlements called OSU and One Oak Baseball Park built on sacred ground. Too big a price to pay for so few survivors left around. No one should ever have to ask, where is Sandpipe Hill? In other words, stop building on sacred land, chill. Help Black Wall Street to rise from the ashes again. It's time for blacks and whites to be each other's friends. We will never ever have a race massacre again. All men are my brothers and my kin. Loving each other is how we all win. I will look at a bigot and see my friend. We will never ever have a race massacre again. My name is Brother Arthur. I am your brother. Call me and tell me what we can do to save America and the world. I love America. And if America is destroyed, my family and I are destroyed with it. My phone number is 918-850-6096. At the time of this recording, only 43 survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre were still alive. Mr. George D. Monroe, one of the survivors, said, I want people to know. I want my children to know that their daddy went through something. There's much more to know about the worst race massacre in American history. There is a documentary about it entitled Before They Die. It will make you cry. Almighty Creator of us all, please do not let any of us fall. Help us to pick up each other when we do. We don't want humanity to be through.
I mean, I will make a friend of someone who does not look like me. That's how we all will save humanity.
So that's our contribution, our musical contribution to this infamous incident that we talked about. Are you there, Imam? Hello? Well, let me see.
I'm sorry, I had it on mute so I could listen.
Oh, okay.
I didn't put in background sound sometime when we were broadcasting. We may have children or friends or other walking by. And, you know, it's somewhat entertaining for some of our people to have fun at the expense of others. And I
think it's worth it. Right, I understand, yeah.
So I appreciate our audience's patience. It seemed that some time, you know, I had a father that was very serious about freeing us. And out of 13 of us, I think the only one of his 13 children that took a real interest in the freedom struggle. Maybe I took it too seriously. My father would say that, but I truly don't. You know, this Tulsa massacre, I believe, Brother Imam, is a major factor why we justify in our mind and perhaps a rationalization in our psyche why we won't go forth and support the CPC, why we won't go forth and support them. If we do it, the white man ain't going to let us do it. Look what happened in Tulsa. Will you comment on that and how we overcome it?
Well, to know that we did it once, to me, says we can do it again. And
that's what it says to me.
Yeah. Tulsa, back in the day, was known as, first it was known as Negro Wall Street, and then as the language changed with the times, it became Black Wall Street. I think Booker T. Washington coined that phrase, Negro Wall Street. He came to Tulsa and was so impressed at the resilience of the former slaves and ancestors of the slaves and what they had done. They built their community up. I mean, literally built the community up to be a prosperous, thriving community. And how that came about was the Caucasians wouldn't let us come into their communities. So when we worked and, you know, worked and got our paychecks, we would bring our money back into our own community and spend that money with each other. There are estimates that the dollar bill went around from 35 to 63 times in our community. You know, that's saying a lot. That $1, the person at the candy store got some of that money. The movie theater got some. The hotel got some. The restaurant got some. The shower parlor got some. The chili parlor got some. The confection store got some. I mean, that's the way it was. We spent money with each other, and so much so that, you know, the other folks, many of the other people, got jealous and envious.
How many stores did we have in that? We had theaters, movie theaters. Tell me what, you didn't have to leave out of Greenwood, rather.
No, you didn't have to leave Greenwood for nothing. We had over 600 African-American-owned businesses in a one-mile radius. Down Greenwood from one end, which was Pine, all the way down to another end, which is Archer, we had over 600 African-American-owned businesses. We also had brothers with airplanes. In fact, the first airplane was a brother owned by a brother named Simon Berry. The brother had his own plane. He started the bus company, the jitney company, and they got so jealous and so envious of him that they arrested him on trumped up charges of tax evasion and sent him to prison. And that's happened to a lot of our brothers and sisters. When they got prosperous and was really thriving and had a successful business.
Buddy, man,
envious of motor school, brother. And then all the lives that were lost. This thing, the 1921 massacre, is not something that people around here talked about. In fact, it has never been talked about in any school book You know, some people quietly share different aspects of it with their family. I can remember looking back when I was about, I must have been about 12 or 13. My great-grandfather was here and lived to be 111, and he loved to talk history. And just one day out of the clear blue sky, he said, "I killed a white man." And it was just like he was thinking it, and he said it out loud, and he saw me listening so intently, and I could tell the way he looked at me that I should never, ever, ever repeat that. And as I found out later, there's no statute of limitations on murder. But right. You know, but we were defending ourselves, literally defending ourselves, with mothers running down the street holding their babies and the fathers coming back behind them with the guns trying to protect them. You know, we had people who ran for their lives in every direction. A lot of them never ever came back. I've talked to some people who know some people that never ever came back to Tulsa. They never want to take a chance with losing their loved ones in that type of a situation. And a straight out massacre. And you know, when people, I mean, just soldiers on the other side, you know, were killing people. They were so jealous and envious. We found out that when they had us hold up our hands and they forced us to go to the internment camps, that wasn't for our own protection, as they said. It was mainly so we wouldn't be visible or aware of them going into our homes and burning and stealing our nice furniture, nice piano, nice channel set. It was a thing that was done out of jealousy. We found out that it wasn't spontaneous as they said it was, because some of the Caucasian business people who had us working for them made sure that their maids and butlers, et cetera, were working on those 2 days, so they couldn't accidentally or intentionally be killed or wiped out. So it was an intentional plan to destroy a vibrant community, not because those people were doing bad, not because those people were gangsters, because those people were trying to get their share. And anytime you try to get your share, you're going to make some people unhappy. But in spite of that, we have to rebuild, and we did rebuild. And then they came with another disguise of destruction, you know, called urban renewal. I remember once, it was in 1990, Imam W.D. Muhammad, no, it was, eight, it was in 1980. 1980, Imam Muhammad came to Tulsa at our invitation to be our main speaker at the banquet, and we were riding him around and taking him up a tour of Black Wall Street, and he talked about urban renewal. He said, "Brother Imam," he said, "this is a plan that they've brought throughout all of America, a plan that they've used the wicked elements in the government to destroy our communities." And, you know, so, but in spite of it, you know, we got that determination. You know, like many cities, Rosewood, Florida, many places, the same thing happened. It was always the same lie: is the brother raped some white woman. And in this case, the interesting thing came out with Sarah Page and Dick Rowland. They were girlfriend and boyfriend, and left, snuck out of Tulsa, and met back up in Kansas City, Missouri, where we heard they eventually got married. You know, so a lot of lies, a lot of corrections that need to be made, and we ask our listening audience again, don't keep that lie alive by letting people call it a riot. It was a massacre. And if you take your time to look up the definition of riot and massacre, you'll come to the conclusion very quickly that's exactly what it was.
Now, what has been the effect upon the citizens, the African-American citizens, of Tulsa? I know you've kept this alive because you are one of them. I'm going to tell this audience something that I know for a fact. We got to stop kidding people. You are one of the trusted imams, and you know you're too humble. If I were near you, I might get a karate chop for saying this. But you are one that's trusted by Imam Muhammad. So, you know, a lot of us, when you listen to this, it's important for our people to know who is trusted and who is not. You know, I'm gonna be honest. My heart is burdened to see Minister Louis Farrakhan on the back page of our paper. That bothers me to know him. One of my sons said, he's a 16-year-old. He said, Daddy, that hurt me as much as, now that's the second most painful day in my life, to see Minister Farrakhan on our paper and to pass an Imam Muhammad. So people are doing what they can to discourage us. And I really believe that these two massacres, one a psychological massacre, and the other one a physical massacre, is done to discourage us from taking our share of this material world. I was wondering if you would comment on this.
Yeah, I accept that reality. There was an imam in Kansas City, his name was Yahya Farrakhan. And he came up with a bunch of young brothers and took a tour, had us to take him on a tour of those 35 blocks and beyond. And we're trying to be sister cities. And he was sharing with me that it was deliberate. It was intentional. And not just, you know, a handful of people in Tulsa and the surrounding areas knew about how successful the Black Wall Street was, but many, many people knew, and they didn't want a model ever to be visible to other of our ancestors throughout the country that could duplicate that. They did everything they could to discourage us. In fact, one of the questions that has been asked is how much in dollar amount does that amount to, that massacre, that destruction? And we don't know. We got estimates, but we really don't know. Because one of the things the city of Tulsa did is they said that the only way you could rebuild is you had to have fire insurance, and nobody had fire insurance before. You know, fire insurance, because they wanted to make sure that you weren't able to rebuild. So all kinds of excuses. And psychologically, it has bothered a lot of us. It has affected a lot of us, because I've talked to a lot of brothers and sisters about the economic times that we live in and how tough the economy is and stuff. And they say, Brother Arthur, what are we going to do? You know, many of these are degree people. I know some PhD people that are looking for a job. And it's interesting when we share with them what Dr. Elijah Muhammad shared with us, three words, do for self, that most of them had never, ever considered doing something for themselves, not selling pencils, not selling popsicles, not selling nothing. Just if you can't get a job for Whitey, then God, good God Almighty, because I ain't going to be able to survive. So psychologically, it continues to take its toll on us.
Well, you put that to a wrap. You already put it to lurk. If I can't get a job for Whitey, good God Almighty, I ain't going to do nothing. I tell you, buddy, man, we got to get you on the circuit. We have to have... Because what you represent is Al-Islam applied in circumstance. I'm not talking about in some book. You know, we have some guys masquerading as they're going to be the exponents of Imam Muhammad's applied teachings of Imam Muhammad. Imam Muhammad's teachings is already applied. It doesn't need to be applied. All it needs to do is be curved to the people and lived. You know, we have these great philosophers. They write in Muslim journals. Applying the teaching of Imam Muhammad. Man, Imam Muhammad showed us how to get our culture back, how to get our economics back, how to get our whole nature back. So I don't see any need to apply it. It already is applied. Now, I want to ask you, has there been any reconciliation by the Caucasians of Oklahoma? And have there also been any discussions of reparations for the descendants of that massacre? And I'm so glad you destroyed that word, a riot. Now, our people was asserting our rights as American citizens, but they wouldn't have to assert that right as American citizens if they were American citizens. So the Irish would not be considered American citizens.
Yes. There was a race riot commission formed several years back to study the so-called riot, the massacre, and make recommendations to the governor and others as to what to be done as an act of atonement. And they came up with we would help educate the children of the descendants, and we will acknowledge it. We'll put up a memorial that will mention the businesses that were destroyed and you know, and blah 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 blah. But when the rubber met the road, so to speak, and they actually gave the survivors a medallion, a necklace supposed to be gold. We found out it was some kind of inexpensive metal, brass or something that just had the looks of gold. And you know, up until this very day, right now, brother, these people don't want to do anything to make it light, to make it old. They just want to. Actually, what's happening, to be honest, what we see is happening, brother, and Oprah Winfrey's people were here a few weeks ago, and they were here to study the history of Greenwood, the massacre, the riot, and to do a mini-series on it. So they kept me from the meeting. I knew they were in town, and I did everything I could to try to find out where they were. But some of the African American, I guess in this, I could say Negro, you know, some of the Negro political people made sure that I didn't know. But at any rate, you know, God works with wonders the way He wants to work them. And one of my colleagues, fantastic brother, he's a Unitarian. His name is Reverend Gerald Davis. He was in the big meeting. And he was saying that basically the conversation was about Dick Rowland and Sarah Page and you know, and this perceived racial problem and blah 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 blah, and that was the reason for the massacre. And he stood up. In fact, others told me that the same thing. He stood up and said, "We need to quit telling lies about what happened and why it happened. This was not about a white woman and a black man. This was about the government wanting to take our land and had to come up with some justifiable ways of taking our land." And I'm told that Oprah's people were very happy that he shared that with them. And then I just was privy to a letter from Oprah's right hand person who was here, thanking him for shedding the truth on what really went down. This was not about sex between a brother and a white woman, consensual or not. It was about making another move to destroy our land. I went to the lawnmower shop several years ago, maybe 20 years ago, and it was owned by a Caucasian old man. I walked in, and I'm just attracted to old folks. I always have been. I've always set up on the old people. And so this guy, you could tell he was the owner because he was behind the register. And he was looking to make sure, I guess, his workers were going to do the right thing. So I said, "Hi." He said, "Hi." And then I told him, you know, I'm in here to get some repair on my lawnmower. And he called the workman over and told him to look at my lawnmower. Give us a chance to talk a little bit. And I asked him how old he was. He said he was 92. I said, "Oh, that's wonderful." I said, you from the Tulsa area?" He said, "Yeah, I'm from Tulsa." He said, "I'm actually from a little town outside Tulsa. I forget what the name of that was." But I said, "Well, were you here in 1921? And his eyes looked up, and he looked at me. His eyes lit up, and he looked at me, and he said, "Yeah." He said, "I was down there on Greenwood with my daddy, and I saw biplanes drop firebombs on your people." And I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yes, I witnessed that." He said that was a terrible thing. He said that hurt me. I didn't know what a biplane was, but I went home and got on the internet, and it's just a two-seater plane, basically an open plane, to where you could throw stuff out if you wanted to. So some of the historians, some of the
and I'm not trying to make this a racial thing. I'm just telling the facts. There was a Caucasian historian who has been preaching quite loudly that no fire bombs were dropped, that our ancestors would say they saw fire bombs or fire or kerosene bombs, that they were out of it. They had must have psychological damage and couldn't remember exactly what happened. But this man, this Caucasian man, 92 years old, verified what our ancestors have been whispering to us and telling us for many, many, many years. So you say, what is the first United States city to be bombed from the air? It was Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. That's the reality, whether we're ashamed of it or not. Now, you say, that how do many of the Caucasians feel about it? Many of them are hurt. Many of them are hurt in their soul about it. And they come up to me all the time. You know, God has blessed me to be very visible in this town that I was born in. And because of the teachings of Imam W.D. Muhammad, even though my name is Farrakhan, they know that we're all about humanity. We ain't about just one race. We're trying to be fair and just and get dignity for every human being, and that's what every one of us just deserves. But I've had some private conversations with some of them, and they say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for what my people did to your people. I'm sorry. What can I do to make up? I say, none of us can do to make up. We wasn't here. I wasn't here. You wasn't here. I said, in my own soul, I feel your sincerity about you offering your condolences and y'all saw y'all what your ancestors done. And I said, I'll pray to God that whatever burden that you have, that God remove that burden from you. And I found that many of them are quietly working behind the scene to make sure that justice come to those that were denied justice then and now.
Let me ask you this, Brother Man. Before I get to a really hard-hitting question, why is it that Muslims in our community, under Imam Muhammad, who loved al-Islam and reflected al-Islam and was had the greatest insight in al-Islam since our Prophet, why is it that our leaders and our members are not fired up about the conditions of our people? And this kind of message shouldn't resonate with them. I mean, I'm moved. I could feel the fire. I could see that our people suffering. I could see that China smashing. You know? I grew up in the South, and I'm not here to bring this up to bring a vengeance spirit. But I want to ask that because I have two other very important questions to ask you. Would you comment on that? The first question is, why isn't we as a community excited about our history, and excited about our connection, and excited about reconnecting our people to that nature as given by our beloved leader and teacher, Imam Muhammad?
I think, Brother Imam, that one of the major reasons is we've gotten into personality worship. We think that even though some of us can read the Quran in its original text, we think that if somebody doesn't co-sign for us, well, the insight that we have, one of them so-called big-headed imams, if they don't bring it, then it's not for us to bring it. That we need to be quiet about it until those who know more than us talk about it. We did Jumu'ah yesterday, and Allah blessed us. We came from Surah Balad. Like Uksanu behind that Balad, Antayilun behind that Balad. I do call the witness this city. And you are a free person in this city. And it went on and on and on, and it talks about the two highways. Well, my Azraqa, Mal Aqaba. And what would explain to you the path that is steep? If you go over in this, in Ayat 13, it's Faku Raqaba. It says, freeing the bondman. You know what that means? It means free the captives of war. And this that we have experienced is a war and part of a war. And Allah has made it clear here that
we should be about helping those that have been, and not just helping those, but freeing those that have been captives of war, psychologically, physically, but mainly psychologically. If you go over to 16, it says, "Well, Miskina, that matter about." My wife and I were blessed to go to the Holy Land. We spent a couple of weeks over, and you see people sitting down. I remember seeing one scene where it was a mother sitting down with three children around her, and she had her hand out, and she said, "Miss Keen, Keen." I didn't know that word so well. I had heard that word, but I hadn't really studied it. Miss Keen means a person whose spirit is so low that basically they are not much higher than the dust that they sit in. Because of their spirit, because of their mind, because of the psychological locks that are around their mind. One of the things, brother, that, man, I feel it so strong. One of the things that Imam W.D. Muhammad said, and I know he didn't just say it to me, but he said it to me. He said, "Brother Imam, let's get busy making sure that the outer community has the correct image of our community, of what we're really all about." That's been my mission. That's been my charge, brother, since the Imam dropped that. And if we just look in the outer community and see the predicament that our people are in, brother, if we're not moved by that, it means we're supposed to be in dead. You know, a snake is a cold-blooded thing.
I want you to explain to us that ayah, which says, "Answer alone." That way, it really obligates us to see ourselves. I mean, I think in that word is halal. That we all, but it's deep. The meaning is so rich. How we should be obligated to the country. And I mean, when I think about Africa or Greenwood, you know, it just seems to me I'm moved to see our young people wasting their lives and violence. I believe if African-American young people knew what had gone on before, I don't believe they would be able to do what they're doing. Do you?
No, I don't. And praise be to Allah, we've got some young brothers that come to Juma with us in their 20s and 30s. And, man, them brothers, brother, they feel it. I mean, they feel it and they see it. And a lot of them, I don't think, are doing a whole lot. They're kind of trapped in limbo. But
long as they are under you, it's just a matter of time. It's like putting dynamite into a cave. Eventually, it's gonna blow up. And I believe that those young men that are listening to you, you're one of the few. Before I ask some other questions, I want to ask you about some of the work you're doing. You were known on the media as the anti-witch doctor, and you have found a way to really ease into the culture. And I was wondering why you decided just to dig into the culture and drop these lyrics. Because it seems to me that's why you're getting young people coming to listen to you. And I may be wrong, but it's that you are bringing a message to them at that level without condescending to them. Will you please comment on that?
Allahu Akbar. Yeah, I have to give the praise to Allah, brother, and be real specific of how that came about. We've been working with youth professionally, for about 30 years or more. That's what I was paid to do. In fact, managed a program for the government. And so I've been thinking about youth. I've got youth. You know, I've got 5 sons and 2 daughters. You know, at one time, 3 of my sons were locked up in prison. Now it's 2, and both of them should be getting out real soon. So basically how I learned these keys were and working with youth, not youth, other youth in the neighborhood, playing basketball with them, playing soccer with them, bringing them in the house, giving them a meal. In fact, one young brother, I've got that letter. I intend to put that letter on Facebook. One young brother wrote me a letter. He said, "Brother Arthur, you're not going to remember me, but one time when you came home, I was in your house with your son. And he told me nobody is allowed in the house except the children, his children, your children, when he's gone." He said, "You came in and you looked at me, and I could tell you wanted to do something to me because you didn't want me in your house violating your rules." He said, "But what you did," he said, "eventually made me become a Muslim." He said, "Instead of you beating me up or cussing me out or saying something harsh to me," he said, "you went over and got the Quran and you read some of the Quran." He said, "I don't know what you read. I don't remember what you read." He said, "But you doing that, you having a choice to hurt me, I having a choice to turn me to God, made me become a Muslim believer myself." And I said, "All praise to Allah." I don't remember that. But in terms of some other things that we've done, again, it goes back to a conversation that we had, that I had with Imam Deputy Muhammad. I said, "Brother Imam, how can we reach our youth?" At that point, I had wrote a book about the youth, How to Solve Inner City Gang Problem, and was really, really perplexed as to, it seemed like with all this effort, we get such positive results. And the Imam said, "Look me right in the eye." I guess I was really paying attention. And now he said, "Brother Imam," he said, "the only way that we're going to reach most of our youth, including the Muslim youth, is through music." I said, "Wow." Yeah, and then he said to me on another occasion, "Brother Imam, it seems like our imams are afraid to get involved in the entertainment culture." He said, "Because I've talked about it and talked about it, Harlem of the culture, the music, and et cetera." And he said, "It doesn't seem like many of the imams are doing that work." And I heard him clearly. And I couldn't do nothing about the other imams, but I could sure do something about coming up with some music. So Allah bless me. I wrote some songs and went in the studio, found some of them beat masters. They put some of them hypnotic beats together along with the lyrics. And praise be to Allah, there's a significant number of young brothers that are listening to my music, you know, and it's helping to wake some of them up. You know, and I'm telling them, I'm asking them, "What can I do to be better? What can I do to be more effective?" And they're saying, "You got to get it out. You got to get it on the radio." When you start trying to get this stuff on the radio and TV, then you begin to see the enemies that we have. And the Imam Muhammad said again, he said, "The most important thing that we can do is to help our people come up with a natural culture that's comfortable to be in."
Right. He didn't say to help them become Muslim, but to help them have a natural culture. Now, you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. I mean, this is going to be repeated several times, and I hope you'll come back one day. Now, because we got to get this out. Our people just don't know what needs to be done. I understand. Right. You know, you may be too young, Brother Imam, to remember the hippies having a big festival called Woodstock. And also, we had Woodstock affected so many tens of millions of people. In fact, it was, I think they called it a watershed year. And the culture, in my opinion, the deterioration of America. But imagine if we could have a great beat contest right there in Tulsa. And who should lead it? But Imam Arthur Farquhar. I want you and I want our audience to pray that religion means alive with seed of money. Because, brother, if God blesses us, and I believe God will bless us, with the money and resources, we're going to follow that methodology and we're going to give a contest for the best, cleanest beat. See, we need to come up with a new name for our music. I like it. I call it Halal Beat, H-B, hidden. You know, and we got a sister that I want to bring on the program. She sings gospel music. You said, "Brother Young, she sings gospel?" Damn right. She said, "Good news. All we have to do is check out Jesus." I know that I've got my good Christian friends listening, one of my good Christian preacher friend, my niece is listening right now. God bless you, niece. God bless you, Reverend. But we believe that God is in nobody's person, not in Farrar's person, not in L. Ron Hubbard's person. Mr. Farrakhan now teaches his people that L. Ron Hubbard, I guess, is the new savior. But anyway, that's another question. Any of you Farrakhan people, y'all call right in at 805-727-7013 and correct me. But we don't believe that God is in nobody's person. Yes, sir.
I have a suggestion, brother, something that we can do to really, with the Lord's help, make a dent in this thing. I'm aware of it. You probably are too, but I know I am because I've had a lot of youth contact me over the years about my music. And they've asked me if I will listen to their music. And some of it, in my opinion, needs to be developed a little bit more. But, brother, some of these youngsters, Brother Imam, brother, Allah has blessed them, brother, to come up with some music and some beats, brother, that can help turn this thing around.
But let's bring them on Religious Means Live. We can turn this broadcast in. We have 21 hours a week. I'm willing to give them half of that time at no cost to them. If they can bring something that can heal our people, you know, I know you were telling me about the young brother down in Arkansas that was involved in a head-on collision, and I know
right.
He understands that Almighty God get him around for work. He might be the new brother who will be the hit beat, the beat master. Maybe God wants him to bring in a new beat. We want to have that kind of music on radio. I also want to make a new announcement. Starting next Saturday at 1 o'clock, Brother Wally Muhammad, the communicator, will return to the air on Religion Means Alive. He will be on for 2 o'clock. So anybody else, if you can get some of your beat masters to come on and play that infectious music, brother, we can build a movement that way, I'm telling you. So I'm willing to have a program where we got 2 hours of music.
Our conversation today is very timely. Look, you got Brother Wally coming on next week. He's got a ton of ideas. He's been in the industry for years and years, and I'm sure he knows some of these youngsters that the radio stations won't get no play. I talked to
the
radio stations.
Get a play, and I have an angry son. I hope he's listening, too. But, you know, see, all you individualists, our religion doesn't support individualism. Our religion gives support to the group. If I were thinking about an individual, I would have just forgotten myself. I've been somewhere in Paris. An old man with a pretty white girl sitting on the left bank of the left bank of Paris somewhere, writing a novel. But I forgot that. I decided that I was going to help John Black Muhammad raise my people when I saw that there was a better leader who had some better medicine. I went to him, Dr. Wahidin Muhammad, and he told me he could heal our people, and I believe him. So what I'm saying is, there is no reason why all of us shouldn't get in the car. Let me ask you, buddy, man, there's a thing floating around in the public sphere and the blogger sphere about reparations. Would you support reparations for our people?
No, sir. The average one would spend money on a headache, brother. I would believe in reparations for those who are on the top, who understand the importance and make investments so that money turns over, we can rebuild our communities. But for the average one of us, brother, we're gonna go buy a new set of clothes and some shoes to impress. Brother Imam, our people are begging for a comfortable identity. I saw a brother the other day. We've been talking about people sagging, and you can see their drawers. This man is wearing drawers on his head. so we will do anything, brother, to get some attention, because that deficit, that deficiency from slavery and afterwards is still there, brother. You know, we got to find ways of reaching that human being inside. Because we're begging for some acknowledgement. We're begging for some esteem. I heard of a brother, one died the other day. He bet who could drink this 187-proof pint of whiskey. And he drunk it and died. So we need to stop competing as damn fools. And then, you know, I mean, and I don't know, buddy. I don't think for the group of us, the big group of us, I think reparations will send us right to where we better hang on now, straight to hell. But for people like yourself and myself and a few others, I'm going to
so you know what would happen if we got $1 trillion in 2 days? It'll be gone.
Yeah.
No, but what we need is the reparations of our mind.
Yeah.
We need to work.
We need our minds to be repaired.
We need our lives to be repaired. And I think once our lives are repaired, we got more self-esteem. When the army lied to Muhammad, had us pool our pennies, dimes, nickels, quarters, dollars, and we did for self, I think that would do more to shame the white supremacists and more to empower us than trillions of dollars if they were to give it. Now, I'm not going to tell you that we're not owed it, but the first thing they need to do is give money to those of us who have the psychotherapeutic tool to heal our people. Our people, like you said, that man walking around with a pile of nasty underclothes around his head. And you know what? I'm telling you, brother, man, I predicted that would grab us.
Yeah.
And showed me that eventually you're going to have a time. I told one of my sons that. He walked around, he had dreads, he had this on his head. So I said, well, why are you doing this? He said, because I want to have my own mind. I said, I can show you 10 people right on this block, they got the same mind you get. Why don't you get something original? Why don't you come and put a cow dung on top of your head and then put a mule on top of the cow dung? He said, I don't want to do that. I said, well, you say you're original. You want to have your own mind. Well, it's not your mind. It's somebody's mind. Somebody manufactured for you. And that's where our people are. Yes.
If we look at this, the way Allah blesses us to look at it as scientists, and I heard you once on your show say you de-niggerize folks. Man, that's wonderful.
Yes,
because our people de-niggerize. Let me share with you an observation. For years, I wondered, even though I was working with gang members, Crips and Bloods here in Oklahoma primarily, why the gang life had such an appeal to them. Such a hold on them. And after listening to what the imam said and thinking about it and praying on it, brother, Allah bless me to figure it out. We, the African-American men, women, senior citizens, we barely have a comfortable identity for ourselves. In fact, many don't. If you ask them what their ethnicity is, you'd be shocked at some of the stuff that you hear. But at any rate, I was wondering, why does that blue and why does that red have such an appeal? In my opinion, it has such an appeal because our natural skin has so of a disappeal. So the youngsters say in their subconscious, you know, y'all arguing over colored and black and Negro and Afro-American and all that kind of stuff. So we're going to find a color that we can identify with that we would die for, and hence you got these colors, the reds and the blues. And they hold on to them or would die for them and kill each other for over them colors. Because now they're in a color that they feel comfortable with, that makes them feel good, that gives them dignity, that causes people to respect them. So I just wanted to share that part with you about the gangs and the colors, buddy, man, and your listening audience. We got to understand the logic behind a lot of this madness that we see, because there's logic behind it, all of it.
And, brother, there was a lot of us who came into the Nation of Islam, and I was reading about one of your ministers, and he hit that mindset. They were the Star Crescent gang. They didn't have any respect for God and people. A lot of us, the latter group that came in the Nation of Islam, were groups of people who just wanted something to make them feel good and to feel above them. So we had our gang. Yeah, we had the sun, moon, and star gang. We didn't come because we had reverence for God. And when we had an opportunity to transfer over, many of us are right now in Islam to be superior. We don't want to be Willie Johnson's child. We don't want to be Clarence Smith's boy. We don't want to be King Bubba. We want to be spiritual. But we don't understand the human identity crisis. And you're right, buddy,
yes,
ma'am. I'm proud to say I have a DDS. It doesn't stand for Doctorate of Dental Sciences. It stands for the Doctorate of Denigrification Sciences. And I'm glad to have the anti-witch doctor to help me. But we may have to do a stop. I'm telling you, a lot of times this sounds like a joke. We may have to do a dance around this country. I mean, I'm serious. And have a dance called the sweep out. Get out, nigga. Get out. Get out. Get out. But that, I'm telling you, we had shows like that. It was shocked out people. Our people need to be shocked out of this consciousness. And then we can get people back.
I was blessed, Buddy Imam, to be invited to Little Rock, Arkansas by this brother that you talked about that had this head-on collision. The Lord bless him and his wife, even though the person that hit him was doing over 100 miles an hour. And as I was getting ready to do the show, which was my first and only show, I was getting ready, and I was showing one of my sons the information that they were putting out about me. They put me down as the hip-hop witch doctor because I got a song about the hip-hop witch doctor. And my son looked at that, and he's a very creative person. He looked at that, and he said, Daddy, he said, you're not the hip-hop witch doctor. You are the hip-hop witch doctor's doctor. And he said, what you should do when you do the show, you put on a Dr. Smock and a stethoscope, and you put your prescription pad and your pen in your pocket, and you put that doctor's hat on your head, and you go out there, Daddy, and perform surgery with your music on them people. And praise be to Allah, we went and we did it. And, you know, and every now and then we get somebody who asks us about the hip-hop witch doctor's doctor. I'm aware that some of those big major ones like Snoop and some of them, brother, they have listened to my music. I know that because I know closely some of the people that work very closely with them. And I don't care about getting credit. I don't care about not getting no money.
No, let me tell you something. I don't know when you saw this picture. I saw a picture of Snoop reading the Quran. See, we have to understand that these young people, we betrayed them. I'm not talking about all of us, but in the 60s, we went on Black Power. We started following the God of rock and roll. And these are our children. And even those in the mosque, we betrayed them. So they are angry. They picked up all kinds of tools. So I want to, we had Maymay on. Now, she may spank me, too. Hope she doesn't have a whip out. Sister Marion Molly, she doesn't use the name Maymay no more. She threw that. She said, she talked about, and we had Brother William Kareem, I hope he's listening. We talked about, she and talked about Muslims saying gang, and you just talked about two of your children that had fallen victim to street life. You know, the most popular magazine in the United States now today, they can't keep enough copies on the shelf. And that's a magazine called Fetch Magazine. Finding every dimension of the streets. That's what our young people read. They're not reading Muhammad's speech. They ain't even reading the Final Call. Their preacher, their minister is Rick Ross. Their bishops is Kanye West. Their first lady is Beyonce and Jay-Z, Kendrick Lamar. That's our priests. That's our popes. So you parents, you better be aware. I don't care whether your kids are there in Assalamu Alaikum. They sitting back listening to trap music. So y'all better watch out, man. You catch your child in the trap. And what about, well, that's a good Muslim kid. Tell us something about this naivete that a lot of us Muslim parents and good Christian parents seem to have.
Yeah, it's kind of kind of sad, brother. We have so many parents in denial. you know, what I have, the conclusion I've come to is the average one of our youth are in bad shape psychologically. That's why they don't come to the mass yet. And if they do, they don't come regularly because they don't see us as relevant. They see those as relevant, their age, their peers. You know, they see us as, I ask them, I say, just tell me how you feel, and they're going to make me mad. I ain't gonna hurt you. I'm going to love you even more. Just help me to understand the dilemma that we're in. And even my granddaughters, and I got some beautiful granddaughters physically, but they love them other guys. Forget them roughnecks. They love them roughnecks. And again, it's the same reason. Because they feel low self-esteem. Even though they're physically beautiful, they feel low self-esteem. So to feel better about themselves, they got to go and hook up with the no-good dude that ain't worth a quarter, that everybody know ain't worth a quarter, but everybody's talking about him. Everybody's talking about how cool he is. Everybody's talking about all this stuff that he's about. So if they can hook up with him, who's got his self-esteem raised because he's acting a fool and people are looking at him and they liking him, then the girls that hook up with him share in his self-esteem because they don't have no low, they don't have high self-esteem either. It's a vicious cycle. Amen.
This is real. Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry. I put you on mute because I didn't want the background noise.
Okay, I got you. Yes, sir.
We have to ask ourselves, what I'm hoping that early 2015 we can have a summit. And I just think the imams like you and I should go on a listening tour and just listen to our young people. I mean, you know, Stanley, the time is out for talk. We have talked to them enough. And now maybe we need to hear from them. We need to have a public hearing. What in the hell is going on? Not just the Muslim young people, our young people. We have to admit we have failed them.
Yes.
Why are three of our young people in the criminal justice system? When our young girls are having babies. Now, we also got to know that there are a lot of our children not involved in it. But anytime you got one out of three, you're in a crisis.
And the problem that I hear from those of our youth that are doing quite well is, I've heard this literally, in order for me to get some attention from my parents, I got to act a fool. It looks like the only one in our family that's getting the attention is the foolish child. The one that's going to school regularly, making good grades, they ain't pregnant, got out of trouble, can't get no love, can't get no attention. What's up with this? That's exactly what I've been asked. By many. So they say the squeaky wheel gets the grease. We got to define squeaky another way.
Yes. My question becomes, how do we celebrate our successful children? And I think we have to do that with culture. I think we got to develop a culture. I think that we got to take this massacre in Tulsa. Show what has happened. And put ritual and put dance to it. And then we need, this is the time of year, we should celebrate all the victorious things that happened to us over the past year. Until we get together, brother, man, I believe in develop a culture for our people, a comfortable cultural life for our people, we'll be having this conversation on somebody else's plantation. Maybe the Indians, maybe the Arabs, somebody else, if we don't stand up and do this kind of work. What do you think of that?
Brother Imam, as those that Allah has blessed to do this work, brother Allah's going to elevate us because this is the work that's got to be done. We'll be traveling all over the world, brother. You know?
Right.
And this is what the Imam said we should do. He said this is a priority. Help our people to find a comfortable identity for themselves. That's
very
simple words, man. Let's get busy and do that.
And you know what, brother, man? When we look in Africa, it doesn't seem like even the Africans have a comfortable identity. When you look at Boko Haram, look what they're doing. Do you think they have a comfortable identity?
No, I don't. But let's look at that. Let's just look at that. And then, God willing, I need to get off of here pretty quick. look at what happens, brother. The whole world is talking about Boko Haram. The whole world. What reward, what satisfaction, what could they be getting out of that to cause them to be so unmerciful, to be who they are? They are being recognized. Pictures have been taken of them. They've been on the news. People know them by name. People know them by face. So why not continue to do what they're doing? Because it's getting them, it's satisfying that dignity urge that's not being satisfied legitimately. That's my opinion.
Brother Imam, do you not believe?
Yes, I do.
All right, well,
I love you. I can go about 3 more minutes. I'm going to have to go. I got my granddaughter, one of my granddaughters, and one of my great-grands, and they're waiting on pawpaw, so I want to acknowledge them.
Okay, we want you to acknowledge them, and we certainly appreciate them, and we appreciate them having granddad and great-granddad take a few minutes away. You're a better man than I am. My grand's really probably somewhere cussing me out. But anyway, dear beloved people, and I'm telling you, I ask a lot of forgive me because I don't spend the time. I'm so wound up on this mission. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not going to tell you. I'm burdened. When I see on the back of our paper a man who has worked assiduously against our leader, but we ain't got enough sense but to recognize him, I'm just burdened. So I don't know. I feel redemptive. So you've got about 3 minutes. Give us some closing remarks, brother.
I would say something to me that's very important. And again, in a way, it goes back to something Imam Muhammad said when I was with him once. He was talking about some people in the community. In fact, he was talking about one of the imams. And he said, "Brother Imam, he's not like us." And I'm listening. He says, "He's not a believer." I said, "Okay." And I've come to a conclusion, Brother Imam, that for too many of us, we believe in Allah, but we don't know Allah.
Right.
We have not had a personal experience with Allah. And so Allah is a logic. Allah is something that we say, but internally, it's not our content. Our label can be the label of Muslim or label of believer, but our inner being is detached as far as the east is from the west as being a real believer. If we were, we couldn't do the things that we do. We couldn't say the things that we say. How can a believer do those things, brother? I'm talking about some of the craziness in our own community. How can a believer do that? A believer's not capable of doing that. So you have to come to the conclusion, this is not a believer. I don't give a damn how much I like him or her. They're not a believer.
That's right.
Excuse me for being too passionate.
No, sir, you're being very clear. And I lost a friend behind this. He was trying to describe one of the big, big, big cheeses in our community. I mean, one of the biggest. I mean, he has a facility. But I have to say, this man is having a lot of practices in his center. They're actually following Eastern patterns of worshiping the prophet's birthday. And I said to him, that man is not a believer. He said, "Well, how you don't know that he's entering through another door?" So a lot of us are weak, and we ain't got no courage. So we can't call a spade as a spade. You know, if I see manure in the door of the masjid, I can't say that because it's a masjid, this is not manure. That's what it is. So I don't care what that man says. If that man's action is dead of a disbeliever, I got to call it for what he is. And there are a lot of these people I love personally. I've had great bean pies with them. I've had bean soup with them. I've been
to meetings with them. But they can't be believers. There's no way in the hell world they could be believers. Yes, sir.
I agree. Do you have any calls before I get off, Imam?
No, sir. Let me just ask. Anybody would like to ask Brother Imam a question or make a comment, just dial 805-727-7013. You know, we only have an audience. They just listen. I tell you, this is a hard audience to work with because they listen. If they were taking action the way they listen, brother, we'd be way down the road. But I understand a lot of people just today need encouragement. And if you're on the line and you all you got to do is press one on your phone, and the brother's going to be about another minute. He's got to take care of his grandchildren. We don't want to hold it. Brother, man, we need you to come back again. Maybe you'll come back during Ramadan.
Inshallah, I'm honored to be on your show. I admire your work and what Allah has blessed you to do, and we make dua for you, Imam. And all the other believers on your line and not on the line. There are a lot of us, there are a lot of believers out here, brother. We just don't know each other. But this world would still be existing if there wasn't some believers here.
That's right. Well, thank you, Brother Imam. I want you to go to your family, give them the greetings, tell them I love them, and we are in spirit and in, we are in truth together. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Imam, and the same salutations to you and your family.
Doctor, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullah.
Give it up, people. We have about 3 more minutes. Anybody wish like to make a comment? I want to tell you that on the first Saturday in the month of June the 7th, Wali Muhammad returns to the air with the communicator. I also want to tell you that please send your donations to Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. We desperately need your aid. We have 2 upcoming bills. We have advertising that we have to pay for. We have legal fees we have to pay for. We're incorporating this ministry. So if you just can send us money, we need it badly. Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. We're up in a great campaign. We're fighting the likes of Goliath. We're fighting the likes of Mr. Farcom, our dear brother, dear friend, Rev. Imam Mubashir Akhtar gave me a message yesterday. He was quoting from something that Imam Muhammad had said. I hope he can one day have that message. But brother, we have a lot of work to do. We have to unite and fight to establish this community. We're not going to go out and just let Imam Muhammad be thrown under the bus. We're not going to let Louis Farrakhan come and kick these weak believers over. He can't get to the strong believers. But I want every one of you to tell your friends to listen to a special address that I have tomorrow. My address tomorrow is education is a must. Not something we can think about, not something that we can look at, not something we can be like Mickey Minaj and looking A-N's, but it has to be a message that we have to be in. I think we're out of time. Remember tomorrow, 3 o'clock, we'll be back Monday with Lincoln University. Tuesday we have an open forum. I'll be interviewed on Tuesday. Wednesday, our brother will be back, and we continue. We work it every day around the clock. What religion means alive. Yeah, I'll put this.